Welcome to another Beer with Barefoot. I'm Scott Pape, the Barefoot Investor, and joining me, as always, is our Chief Investment Analyst, Mike Kemp. G'day, Mike.
G'day, Scott. Hello, everybody.
And for those of you who are new to the Blueprint, welcome. I hope you enjoyed this month's Inner Circle on Tax. If you haven't read it yet, you definitely should before you see your accountant. And as a reminder, it's only going to be available for the month of July. Now, we pull it down. The reason we do this is so you can focus on just one step at a time. It's all about making small but powerful changes to your finances every single month that you're in the Blueprint program. Now, on to Beer with Barefoot. This is the place where Mike and I answer your Blueprint questions directly. Now, we've got some corker questions, Mike, this month. But before we get into that, I just want to explain, if you'd like to ask us a question for next month's Q&A session, here's what you need to do. On the Blueprint members site, go to the portfolio tab, then click on A Beer with Barefoot, and you can record a question directly from your computer, just like leaving us a voicemail. And each month, we'll do our best to answer them. So, Mike, before we get into the questions, happy EFI.
End of financial year. That's what you're talking about there,
yes.
Scott. Yeah. Thank you, Scott. I don't normally celebrate it because end of financial year means I have to get all my tax stuff together for my accountant, and I don't really enjoy that process. But one big thing that's happened this end of financial year is my wife is now a self-funded retiree.
Congratulations.
As of 1st of July, after many, many years in the
workforce. Congratulations to Sandy.
She's a self-funded retiree.
Is retirement suiting her well?
I think so.
Yeah.
She's never home.
Never. And you're not retiring anytime soon,
so you're just going to continue
working.
Yeah.
Now, are you excited about our fresh $25,000 that we're going to be investing next week?
You said our $25,000.
Well, ours meaning Liz and I.
Well, I'm excited for you. I'm not personally excited.
Yes. Well, as a reminder of how it works, I'm going to be investing $25,000 of my family's money each and every quarter for the $100,000 live portfolio, four times a year, adds up to $100,000, like that. And you get to look over my shoulder and find out where I think the best value is. Our next investment decision is due in July, where we're going to be investing that $25,000. It's due out on the third Saturday of each month. So that is
Next Saturday.
Now, Mike.
Yes.
Let's get into the first question.
Hi, Scott and Mike. Just an inquiry. You recommend AFIC shares as a good core stock to hold. Would you recommend this stock today at market price? And if so, how many shares would you consider as a starting point to hold? Thank you.
I had a guy ring me over the weekend and he was saying, look, I want to get into the $25,000 a quarter. He'd never done any investing. And I said, what you should do, this is over and above his stuff in his super. I said, I want you to spend the first year or two just investing in AFIC, just getting a feel for the market, the moves of the market.
And get a feel for yourself and how you interact with the market.
Correct.
Because not everyone's suited to be an investor.
Correct. So what I said was, I want you to have your core holding in AFIC.
Yep.
And then what I want you to do is, if you may really enjoy it, if you do, then you can start looking at what we're doing with individual securities, and that may be really interesting to you. It may not be.
Yep.
But this is a really good first step. So to Lynn, I would give you the same advice. If you are investing in AFIC, you are getting a very diversified portfolio, a professionally managed portfolio at a very low cost. And I think that it would be an excellent first investment.
Yep. Now, there's another arm to Lynn's question, though. She asked how many AFIC shares would be a good amount to buy. Now, Lynn, that is a person-specific question. And without seeing your how much money you've got in your bank account, I can't answer that one. For some people, it's not going to be many. Some people, it's going to be a lot. But I wouldn't buy a parcel less than about $3,000 or $4,000.
Good question. Let's get on to the next one.
What percentage should you have in the balanced index fund within super as opposed to individual stocks?
Basically, you have your core holding in the index balance fund. Well, this is how I do it personally. Core holding in that, when I see some value, I will transfer over. And I will buy individual shares that are within the ASX 300. The great thing about this approach, Mike, with having the Choice Plus or the direct investment option, whether you use Host Plus or whether you use Australian Super or ING or any of them, with your contributions, your employer contributions that are going in, you may choose to actually invest that in shares, direct shares.
Yep.
Or you may say, you know what, this is all too much hassle. I'm just going to have the bulk of it professionally managed in an ultra low cost index fund or balance fund.
Yep.
Your view.
I'd like to add to that. Yeah. I don't think there's any rules about how much you should have in an index fund and how much you should have in individual stocks. There aren't rules, but there is very, very important things you need to consider. And this is a individual case-by-case thing. It depends on your interest in assessing individual stocks, of seeing how companies perform. If you have zero interest in looking at individual stocks, then you should be in an index fund and go and do something else with your time. It also depends on your level of skill and your emotion and your makeup. Are you suited to investing in individual stocks? Because some people aren't. They don't have the skills to actually assess individual companies, nor do they have the ticker or the emotional makeup to actually deal with it.
But also, the thing that I do like about this is that it allows you, even if it's, you know, a couple of $1,000s, to go over to buy some shares without having to commit to thousands of dollars in fees to an accountant for a self-managed super fund.
Yep.
It's a really low-cost way. And as we've said, both our wives aren't that interested in investing. And it allows, for me personally, to actually have a professional manager that deals with all the admin and stuff. Let's go to the next question.
One of your recommendations is Collection House, CLH, which I'm hesitant to invest in because of its long-term debt, which is 40% of its capital as at its last financial reporting. When should we be concerned about long-term debt, and why isn't it a factor in the case of Collection House?
Andrew, debt is about an ability to service that debt. And you're right. Yeah, the debt of Collection House is around about 40% of capital, and it has been for many, many years. And we're not ignoring that in our assessment of Collection House. Debt levels are a factor in every assessment of investment. So we haven't excluded Collection House from all of that. 40% of capital, I wouldn't really call that excessive though. As I said, it's about a company's ability to service its debt. And that's an interest cover of about 5x, which is pretty comfortable. Now, what's interest cover? Interest cover is about what a company earns before it pays interest and tax compared to its interest bill. And around about 5x is pretty comfortable. In other words, it can service its interest 5x over based on the last half year result and, as you mentioned, the last 4 year result. So, no, I haven't really got a problem with that. But investing is very much about feeling comfortable yourself. And I'd suggest to you that if any investment, and I'm not just talking about Collection House here, I'm talking about any investment at all. If at any time you've looked at the facts and you feel uncomfortable in yourself, don't invest in it.
Don't do it. Next question.
Hey, Scott and Mike. Just had a question in regards to the first homeowner's grant. After reading Scott's book in December last year, I increased my super contribution to 15%. From the start of this year, I've been trying to save relatively hard for my first home deposit. Just got a question in regards to whether I should be increasing my super contribution again as a way to save for my deposit.
Now, Scott, you just looked at this recently, didn't you? In depth.
I did. I spent a lot of time on this. Ed, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't be increasing my super contributions, my additional super contributions before I buy a house. That's really step five in my book, is to increase your super, but the step before that is to actually purchase a home. So not to actually have it paid off, but to save up the deposit, buy a home. After you do that, what you do is you increase your super contributions from the employer 9.5% to 15%. The idea being that you do that, you're not really going to notice it, but over the next 30, 40 years, it makes a huge difference, that extra 5.5% or thereabouts. But I wouldn't be doing it until you actually own your own home. Now, what Ed was also talking about was using the first home super saver scheme in order to save for his deposit.
You might want to just explain to people very quickly what that is, because not everyone will have understood.
So Scott Morrison on Budget Night came out with this thing called the First Home Super Saver Scheme, which allows first home buyers to actually make voluntary contributions to super and save on tax and take that money out and use it as a deposit. It was greeted with much fanfare. They put a price on it of $250 million. It's going to cost taxpayers. And it's a bit of a turkey, because I spent last week talking to Treasury about it, talking to Scott Morrison's office about it. And what I found was that there has been very little planning put in here, to the point where none of the major super funds actually know that what this policy is.
Policy on the run.
It hasn't actually been, it's not legislation. Mm. It hasn't been put through Parliament. They're saying that it will be put through in September, but as yet it's not law. So anyone who's thinking about using this scheme would have to be very careful because you could be salary sacrificing into superannuation and this may not become law. Mm. And therefore you've got money that you had allocated to your deposit that is stuck in superannuation until your preservation age.
But they've got, my understanding is that they've got a year to think about putting the money in anyway, so they're better off waiting.
Sure.
But wait until they know before they put the money
even
in.
Even then, Mike, I'm kind of meh on this now. I thought it was, Scott Morrison came out budget night, said that it would help first home savers get into their deposit 30% quicker. Playing around with the numbers a little bit. On an average wage, it's worth about $6,000 over a couple of years. To a couple, both on average wage, about $12,000. But you have this thing called legislative risk. What happens if Tony Abbott rolls Malcolm Turnbull, the government gets booted out, they don't have passed legislation that says, hey, you can actually still use this for your deposit? Who knows? Things change so much. And what I saw last week from Canberra, and I'm not being political here, I'm just looking at what they said and then what they have done since May to put this in place is a dog's breakfast. It is an absolute dog's breakfast. Mm. And it was really clear that I think I was the only person in the media that's actually come back and said, hang on, this thing starts on Monday. What's going on?
Yeah.
And they were making things up as I was talking.
And they
to
hadn't
them.
Covered all possibilities or bases. And
No. So for me, Ed, two things. Firstly, I wouldn't be increasing your super contributions now. That is against the barefoot rules. Save up to buy for a deposit. Then after you buy, then start to increase your super contributions, but not before. The second thing that I would say is that I'm going to be looking at this first home savers super scheme when it becomes law, if it becomes law, and I'll have more to say on it over the next 12 months. But right now, I'm putting a freeze on this until we know more. Let's get on to the next question.
I'm looking at the break-free portfolio allocations that you've suggested, and I've got a few questions around those. The first one is in regards to the April 2017 blueprint, where it was recommended we keep 30% in cash. I'm wondering if this applies to the break-free portfolio. My assumption is it doesn't. I'm also wondering why only 20% international was selected. There were no emerging markets nor commodities included. Also, with fixed interest listed as only 10% of the portfolio, it seemed low compared to some other conservative ETF portfolios I've seen online. I'm just wondering if you could possibly answer those questions and wondering why rebalancing is done in December and not in July being tax times. Thanks again, guys. Keep up the great work and hopefully hear from you soon. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Murray. That's great. Oh, actually, I counted four questions there from Murray.
Yes.
But they're all good questions because I think, you know, they're questions that are probably in other people's mind. The first one was about 30%, our recommendation of 30% in cash in the April blueprint versus in our break free, it doesn't apply. I think Murray sort of answered that one himself. No, Murray, you're right. The break free is a passive investment vehicle. It's something you're going to hold for many, many years. It's a long-term, unwavering plan. The reason we talked about a 30% cash holding in the April 2017, we just felt it was prudent given the current concerns in the market. You've got to remember that our blueprint portfolio, what we've had in the past, and also Scott's 100K, is not a passive investment. We are buying and selling. It's totally different than the break free. So, yeah, it doesn't apply to the break free.
Next question was why only 20% international selected?
I think Murray was implying with the way he answered that question, he thought it was a bit low.
Yes.
I actually think for most investors, certainly Australian investors, it's pretty high. I mean,
you don't think we've got a home bias here? Like too much of a home bias?
Oh well, I read a interesting stat in last week's AFR, Scott. It was talking about holdings of in overseas shares, international shares by self-managed superannuation funds in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So comparing 20% in our break free, what percentage do you think the average Australian self-managed superannuation fund holds in international shares?
No idea.
Less than 1%. Murray, I think 20% international shares is quite a high number.
Yes.
I don't think it's low at all.
Emerging markets and commodities.
Well, commodities. I mean, I guess Murray's talking about hard commodities like gold and silver.
What
and
he's probably talking about is Anthony Robbins, the big tooth man, who has his all-weather portfolio, which has he had Ray Dalio do it. He's a hedge fund manager from Bridgewater Associates. It has resources. It has emerging markets. It has just a sprinkling of everything.
It rang a sense with you. Look, commodities, gold, silver, oil. They don't produce any money. They're a punt.
Mm.
Basically, it's a price punt. Is gold going up? Is silver going up? Is oil going? I don't even perceive them as investments. I'd rather invest in the companies that are actually producing them and selling them.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I don't invest in commodities at all.
Fixed interest at only 10% seems quite low.
Fixed interest at 10%. I've never owned a corporate or government bond in my life.
And you were a bond trader, which is...
No, I wasn't. I was a short-term money market dealer.
Okay.
So I don't own them. And if I did, 10% would probably be my upper limit at the moment with interest rates on the rise worldwide.
Sure.
The worst time to hold bonds is in a rising interest rate market. So I don't think 10% is... But this is a long-term portfolio.
This is something that you would be holding for decades. The other thing that I would say just on the international thing, Buffett and Bogle don't invest overseas. They have a home bias to the US.
I've heard Bogle interviewed and asked that exact question, and he says, I do not. This is on his own personal level. He doesn't invest overseas. Buffett has, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Munger, Buffett's mate Charlie Munger, convinced Buffett to invest in BYD, which is a Chinese battery manufacturer.
Build your dream.
Chinese,
that's what it stands for.
Yes, I know. Mm. The Chinese battery manufacturer, I think it was back in 2008, but don't quote me.
Yes.
They do have direct investments overseas, but very few.
Australia has a bias because we have franking credits. We've got dividend imputation, which is another reason.
And of course, if you invest in Australian shares, you are not exposed to currency risk.
Sure.
Nor do you have to pay a high price for hedging if you choose not to have the currency risk. Murray also asked, why is rebalancing done in December and not at tax time? Murray, it doesn't matter what day of the year you do it. You could do it on your birthday if you wanted to. It just needs to be a date you can remember to do it each year. It's got nothing to do with
15 minutes of your time. And again...
It's got nothing to do with tax. I mean, would you be bothered to do that on your birthday, though,
no.
Scott? You wouldn't want to do
no,
that.
No, and I think also the last few years we've said probably don't worry about it because...
the transaction costs for rebalancing would far outweigh any purpose of doing it. Unless you had a huge amount of money... in the break free.
Thanks for your question, Murray. Let's get on to the next question.
Oh, hello, Barefoot. Peter Boy speaking. Do you see any role for bonds as a capital stable investment for people in their 60s? I know your strategy for having 3 years of cash, but interested in your opinion on other instruments such as corporate bonds. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. My answer is no. Mike, yours.
I've got a longer than no.
Of course you do. Come on.
I really get concerned when I hear people say capital stable in the same sentence as bonds. It's false that bonds are capital stable. I mean, as a perfect example, if you'd invested $100K in 10-year bonds a year ago, then your $100K investment would now be worth a little over $91,000. So you'd be down $9,000 on the capital. In fact, the capital value of a long-term bond, or any bond, but more so long-term bond, varies every single day. And in a rising interest rate market, which is what we've been experiencing, the capital value of that's going to fall. Bonds are not capital stable unless you hold them to maturity. Till the day they mature, so 10 years hence. That's when you'd get 100K back. But you say, well, why not wait 10 years? The fact is, if you'd locked in a bond last year at 1.9%, then you're living with a 1.9% interest rate for 10 years.
The other,
there's no free lunch.
The other thing that I would say is that whenever you see capital stable in an investment mix from a fund manager, generally speaking, there is no free lunch in finance.
No, this they
is
often going apply options to it.
This is going to cost you. My thinking
but
is
they don't have to with bonds. You're talking
no,
about
no, no.
I'm talking, capital stable
I'm
equity portfolios.
I'm talking about capital stable investment options.
Yeah, they've hedged it.
That you can.
They've hedged it.
Yes.
And your returns are going to be less.
Correct. So for me, what it is, Pete was, he mentioned this, that the 3 years in cash, what I'm really focusing on there, some people freak out because they think, hang on, if I need $65,000 a year for my wife and I to be comfortable, does that mean that I need $180,000 in cash? Well, no, it doesn't, because if you are on, if you're getting the full rate of pension, that's about 34 grand, right? So you deduct that because that is the most secure capital stable income stream you're going to get because it's from the government.
Mm.
So that's you don't apply that. So it's just the extra $30,000 or thereabouts. So you want to have about $90,000 in cash or fixed interest, or you want to be laddering that in some way, shape or form. But you want to actually try and keep that on ice so that you can draw from it. The rest should be invested so that you can be getting above inflation returns, would be my view.
Yeah, the money I don't have invested in shares, I've got in bank accounts. I've got in cash, which I feel more comfortable in a rising interest rate environment.
Correct. Now, Mike.
Yes.
This is probably my favorite question that I've had since we started doing this.
Okay.
I think I am so excited about this question. So you'll know that we have this private group on Facebook.
No, I don't know that.
You do know that. You just are not on Facebook.
No.
Okay.
I'm certainly not a member of it.
You are certainly not. You are certainly not a member of the Facebook.
Yes.
Excellent. And we have been missing that your representation on that. But there's been a lot of talk about the Host Plus Index Balance Fund,
which we talked about last.
Which
Bear with Barefoot.
We talked about last month. Just for those who don't know, this is a fund that I invest my super with. Liz has her super fund with. I've written about it extensively. I call it the cheapest fund in the world. And some people say it's too bloody cheap. There must be something wrong with it.
Well, yeah, there's that old saying, you get what you pay for, Scott. But people have to realize this is an indexed fund, which is different than a managed fund. And that's a very, very important point. Because as an index fund, they're just tracking an index.
Yeah, but even then they're saying it's
less
effort. It's even cheaper than the cheapest index fund. And I'm like, hello.
Yeah, yes. But index funds fundamentally as a group are cheaper because you haven't got a heap of financial analysts, high-paid financial analysts, trying to beat the market. They're just tracking the index. So they do it with computers and algorithms. There is less money involved.
And there's a lot more efficiency. And that's why we have seen in the years that I have been promoting index funds, they have come down from 1%
yep.
to 0.5%.
Competition.
And we are now into a point with this index balance fund where for every $100,000 you've got invested, it costs you about $200 in management fees. Now, one of our members got so incensed about this that they even created a Google Doc, and that Google Doc was headlined, "It's not all about fees." Basically, he argued that the Host Plus Index Balance Fund, relative to its peers, has experienced lower returns and a higher level of risk. And you would understand that there are a lot of people who have money invested in the Host Plus Index Balance Fund. So this caused a little bit of a hoo-ha on Facebook.
A little while ago, I posted a comment on Facebook to the effect that if you were investing in LICs or in ETFs, you should focus on absolute return net of fees rather than focusing on chasing the lowest fees possible. And Scott, you disagreed with me on that, and I was just wondering if you guys might be able to explain a little why you take that alternative view. Thanks.
Ooh, okay. Bye. Look, it is a great question. There's so many areas you can explore with this. Firstly, I'd like to agree with Ed. It would be great if you could get the best net of fee return. It would be wonderful because that's what all you'd aim for. The problem is that we don't know beforehand what is going to be the best net of fee return because you don't know what their return is going to be. And remember, we're not talking now about index funds. We're talking about managed funds. We're talking about people out there trying to beat the market. We don't know over the next 10 or 15 years because it's all about the future. Now, Ed has added there, but if you look back 10 to 15 years at the various fund managers, then that's the best evidence we have available. I would argue that it's evidence at all, looking back at the past 10 to 15 years' performance. In fact, I would argue it's a trap, because more often than not, the next 10 to 15 years turn out very, very differently than the past 10 to 15 years.
And we see that with the S&P. They have a report that they look at with fund managers to see the top performing fund managers. Generally speaking, they'll be at the top of the table and then they fall back down.
Oh, Scott, let me give you an example of a study I absolutely love. Now, Scott's quite correct. There's been a lot of studies done on this. But one of the ones that really jumped out at me, one of many, is one undertaken by Jack Bogle, who started the Vanguard Fund back in 74, 75. He looked at several hundred US fund managers, and it's been the same story in Australia, so I don't think this is unique to the United States. Jack Bogle looked at several hundred US funds, managed funds, and he drew up a league table. He identified the top 20 US funds over the last 10-year period, and put, so this is historic. This is what Ed is suggesting. You're looking back 10 to 15 years. Bogle identified the top 20 US funds over the last 10-year period. And Scott, how do you reckon they went over the next 10-year period?
Hit me with it.
Okay, well, first of all, the number one fund over the past 10 years came 128th. Okay. And the average rank of those top 20, the top 20 funds over the last 10 years, their average rank was 142.
Wow.
Now, how can you explain that? You might say, well, why can a fund manager that's done so well over the last 10 years do so poorly? In fact, some people laugh about this. They say, your best chance of picking the best fund manager
is the ugly ducklings.
Pick the ones that did worst over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So how do you explain that? I think the first thing is that people dramatically underestimate luck in all of this. Okay, is it possible that the fund managers who did well over the last 10 years were just lucky?
Lucky.
There's two guys, and again, this is another study, two guys called Eugene Famer and Ken French who actually looked at this.
Here we go.
They generated random numbers, right? Totally random, out of a computer, and compared it to the results of fund managers, and the comparison, the statistical likeness between those sets of figures is absolutely amazing. Now, I'm not saying that every fund manager is just lucky. I'm not saying that at all. But we have no way of differentiating between luck and skill. That's the thing. You could well say, well, why don't you watch someone over in a really long period of time, like a Warren Buffett who's been investing mm-hmm. 50 or 60 years. Mm-hmm. The problem is these guys often don't show their skill until they've been doing it for a long, long time.
Mm.
And then you've missed out. Now, I'm not saying the market can't be beaten. There's investors in the US like Seth Klarman, Cliff Arness, Warren Buffett, Walter Schloss, who over an extended period of time have actually have beaten the market. But we are talking about individuals here. In Australia, you could say Peter Hall, perhaps even Kerr Nielsen of Platinum. Ooh. Although he hasn't had a good few years,
both.
I know.
Both?
Yeah, both. Well, both had a good run for like about 20 years and then crash.
And can I also say that the names, the American investors that you mentioned all had one thing in common, do they not?
They were value investors, except you could argue Cliff Arness perhaps wasn't in that category. But look, we aren't talking, when we're talking about fund managers, about individuals. We're usually talking about investment by a group. Not only that, fund managers change. Let's say it wasn't luck. Let's just say a fund manager performed well over a 10 to 15 year period because of skill, and we're not even sure of that. The fact is that same guy or those same two guys or two women, are they going to be the fund managers in that same fund manager for the next 10 to 15 years? They change.
Mm.
They churn. So I fundamentally disagree with Ed. I agree with the fact that it'd be great if we could get best net of fees. That just makes sense. But we've got no way of achieving it. That's the problem.
And to this point, which is this Google Doc that was created, and a lot of time and effort was put into that. And may I just say,
we're talking about risk here.
May I just say that Ed was actually commenting on this document that was created in the Facebook group about it's not all about fees.
Yep.
And one of our members
about risk as well.
Yeah. So basically, he put a lot of time into looking at the risk adjusted returns of the index balance fund versus its peers.
Yep.
And so I guess what I want to focus on is that idea that wouldn't it be lovely if you could package up risk, this concept of risk in the future, into a very eloquent chart.
And plot it on
a graph and then say, there you go.
That's the return you got, but it was more risky.
Correct.
Let's define it. Let's define risk when you're investing.
Yes.
What is the risk? To me, it's the risk of losing money.
Yes.
Or receiving a poor return.
Yes.
Even if you don't actually lose money, you go, oh, I only earned 2%, but if I'd invested in something else, I would have got 6%.
Yes.
Now, first of all, let's talk about measuring historical volatility and then saying what's happened in the past is going to happen in the future. And I heard a fantastic story, well, a fantastic comparison about the Thanksgiving turkey, right? The Thanksgiving turkey for 364 days of the year is thinking about risk. And he's thinking, you know, yesterday was a pretty good day. And then on the 365th day, that it was Thanksgiving Day, that turkey's whole world changed. So historical data is not really a good measurement of risk. The other thing that the academics say is that volatility is a measure of risk. I think the greatest, well, not the greatest, but a really good comment about volatility, that's price movement up and down, being a measure of risk, was said by Peter Carr at New York University. And he summed it up when he said, volatility is only a good measure of risk if you feel that being rich then poor is exactly the same as being poor then rich. In other words, volatility is bi-dimensional. It goes up and down. And it's unsustained and it's short term, whereas real risk, the risk of losing money is unidimensional. I think the whole thing is nonsense. I think making graphs that define risk is nonsense. And if anyone wants to explore it more than what I've just said, chapter 23 of my book, Uncommon Sense. I talk a lot about it.
There's the plug. But The only thing as investors that we can really control, apart from where we invest our money,
the only thing we know for certain
are the fees that we pay.
Death taxes and management fees.
The fees that we pay. So my view was that I get, if you think about it from a race, every year I have my capital invested next to you, Mike.
Yep.
I start 20 yards down the road because I'm not paying a fund manager. So my view is the one thing that we can control is the fees that we pay. And that's really, if we look at the Host Plus Index Balance Fund, you've got what? Exposure to 1,500 shares all around the world. So your Apples, your Amazons, your Nikes, your Nestles, the biggest companies in the world. You have the 300 biggest companies in Australia. You've got cash, you've got fixed interest. It doesn't have property. But then again, I would argue that a lot of Australians, most Australians, have already got an exposure to property through their principal place of residence or their investment properties. So I kind of look at this and think it makes a lot of sense.
I agree. If you don't know which fund manager is going to outperform in the future,
Which you don't.
You're not going to know that. Mm. And as a group, as a total group, they're not going to outperform the market, because when you add them all up, they effectively are the market.
Mm.
So if you don't know which one's going to win, then the only thing you can do is pick the one that costs the least. That's all you can do.
To keep your costs down. So just the final thing that I would say is that there was another post on this same thread, which I thought was really interesting. There's a guy by the name of Daniel Smith, and he says that I've been with Host Plus Balance Fund for the past 20 years. I'm starting to look at the Index Balance Fund. I was curious to see what the difference would be. Yes, the Balance Fund performance has been better, but over the last 10 years, I'm $12,000 worse off because of the fees I've paid. Now, again,
That's his experience. It mightn't happen again.
It may not happen again.
Yeah.
But the one thing that you can be sure of, regardless of where the markets go up, down, or sideways, you will be charged a management fee.
Yep.
And if you are not paying that fee, you are effectively, if you think about it from a race, a 100-yard dash, you are getting a head start.
Correct.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you all for testing these assumptions on the Host Plus Index Balance Fund. You may not agree with us. That is fine. That is what investing is all about.
Yeah, I love to hear people thinking about these
problems. So do I. Well, that's about all we have time for this week. Mike, this has been an extended session.
Yeah, it has. We really got into portfolio theory there, Scott, for a while.
And if you would like to ask a question, you go to the Portfolio tab, then click on A Beer with Barefoot, and you can record a question directly from your computer. And each month, we'll do our best to answer them. We'll be back in your inboxes this time next week when we lay out our plans for my 25K. Till then, tread your own path.